Welcome to part three of We'd Like a Word with Peter May as our guest, with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
Right. I want to ask you about some of the humour in this. So you've got this, you've got people being murdered and betrayed and all sorts of skullduggery going on. And you've got this police officer who has no filter and annoys people.
He just says the truth. And that's an interesting area in itself, because we, in order for society to function, we have to tell white lies all the time, don't we? We have to have these white lies. And when you've got someone who hasn't got those social filters, that's quite an interesting character. I like that.
Where does humour fit in for you?
Humour's always been important for me. I hate books that are 100% po-faced. I think humour's necessary. It lends height to those dramatic moments that come later. You know, the old idea of comic relief and all the rest of it. Things we learned at school, things doing Shakespeare. I think they are important.
What's your favourite comic bit of writing?
I'm trying to remember Tom Sharp, way back in what must have been the 70s. I would be ill laughing at Tom. I can remember I'd been in hospital for a minor operation, but it was kind of painful, and somebody gave me Porterhouse Blue to read, and I was in agony, literally. I could not stop laughing. He was a comic genius, that man.
Yeah. The first time I read a Tom Sharp book was right in the middle of the Brixton riots. Now, I'm a young police officer. I'm sitting on a Green Goddess, one of those big green buses, waiting for a deployment order to go out with riot shields and have bricks and petrol bombs thrown at me. And someone finished a book and said, "Do you want this?" Because we're quite bored sitting on these coaches. And it was The Throwback. I'm literally laughing out loud, howling with laughter as I'm reading this. And then it was like, "Do you pass? You're out. Bombs, you know, petrol bombs, boom, 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 shield. You get back on board. You know, three of your colleagues aren't with you anymore because they've gone off hospital or injuries. Read the next bit." We're off the bus again. And it helped. But yeah, it's been a long time since I've read a book that's made me laugh out loud like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this made me laugh. This bit made me laugh. So this is out of A Silent Death.
Is this a rude bit?
No, it's not. Well, I don't think it's rude. Anyway, so Mackenzie has been brought over from Scotland to collect this gangster guy who escapes. And then they're saying, "Well, you have to hang around a bit longer and help us, you know, deal with this." And the Spanish guy saying, "And your national crime agency has graciously agreed to lend us your services to help us find him, since you are fluent in both languages." Mackenzie stared at him in disbelief. "But I don't have any underwear." And the jefe, the police chief, stared back at him for a moment, frowning, before his face cleared, eyebrows shooting up on his forehead, and he laughed. "I like you, senor. You have that famous British sense of humour." Mackenzie was not at all sure about what was humorous about a dearth of clean underwear. And the chief of police lounged back in the seat and says, "You know, underwear we can do. Hopefully you won't require too many pairs of socks." So then off they go to get him somewhere to stay in. But he's saying, "No, you have to stop and get me some underwear," which is annoying for the police. And he's saying, yeah, and they need to be the right cotton. You know, I react to man-made fibres. And so the underwear theme is continuing. And then we're into chapter 11. Anyway, so Christina's driving him along, and she's driven the police SUV along the pedestrian Calle Real and parked, lights flashing, outside a shop selling men's clothes at budget prices. Mackenzie had given her a look. "Is it legal to park here? We're the police." Which doesn't mean we're above the law, because he recalled being on the end of a similar look from a traffic cop on Boston Road in Hanwell just a few days earlier. "It's an emergency," Christina had told him dryly, and he'd frowned. "What emergency?" "An underwear emergency, apparently." Anyway, that made me chuckle.
I presume you must know Ealing as well, because I lived in Ealing for 3 years, 4 years, so I know Hanwell and all that area quite well. So.
Right, I did a bit of research. Well, I asked somebody who lives in that area, what would be a good place, you know, to set that character, and, you know, and so she had suggested these locations, and I went and had a look and scrambled around and...
He's following me. You've got a cop with no filter, lives in Ealing. Hang on.
It's funny.
Highly intelligent.
But
it's you.
No, that's where it all fell to bits.
I talked about my Mackenzie being based on my two brothers-in-law. I always give my manuscripts to one of those brothers-in-law. And will pick up things in the reading of proofs that I have missed, that a proofreader
has
missed.
That's very useful. That's really useful.
Because he's just got that kind of brain. Mm. I sent him this manuscript to read. And he, of course, recognised himself or certain elements of himself. But he said he spent the first half of the book just laughing out loud at various elements of this guy's behaviour.
That's great.
Which is good, yeah. I mean, it was meant to be funny. I wanted it to be funny. But particularly because then it segues into something that's not so funny. And it's nice to be able to do that kind of juxtaposition of humour and serious drama.
Yeah, as you were saying about something being 100% po-faced, you know, you need light and dark, don't you?
You do, absolutely, yes. Yeah. I mean, as a reader, you need it. I mean, and so I think it's important to be aware of what works for you as a reader when you're writing something and apply those same criteria that would make you enjoy a book.
Mm.
Every episode we have a brain teaser for listeners to respond to. And various people have got in touch about the last one that was set by Cole Morton, which was a really hard one.
It was.
So Cole Morton, the author of The Lightkeeper, and also in the band The Lightkeepers, who created The Lightkeeper album. So he was talking about the book and the album that went with the book. And he had a political question for us, which was, which party leader, British one, got the most votes, so the biggest popular vote in an election,
yeah,
and what year, and whose record did that person beat, so who had the previous record. So it was a four-part question, really, and various people got in touch, and I'm not going to be able to tell you their answers because we are in the basement of the salubrious Crown Plaza Hotel in Blackfriars in London, and I can't get a signal to look up their answers, so I should have printed them out, which is very bad.
But
Janice and Mark and everyone else who got in touch, thank you very much. But I can tell you the answer because Cole sent it to me, and I've got a screenshot of that. So there was a clue that Cole gave away when he was saying he. So it clearly wasn't Margaret Thatcher.
That's not much of a clue, or Theresa May. It's just one person to leave out.
And Theresa May.
What, you thought Theresa May get more votes than anyone else?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, you might think that isn't much of a clue. Not everyone responded to that clue. So female leaders were suggested. But anyway, obviously it was a bloke. So John Major got just over 14 million in 1992, the biggest popular vote in a British election to date.
The last nice Tory.
Doesn't seem that way at the time.
No, it didn't.
Okay, so that's that. So the record he broke was held by Clement Attlee in 1951, was set by Clement Attlee in 1951. Now, he lost the election to Churchill because of the way the votes were distributed, but he got more votes than Churchill. So he had the previous biggest popular vote, which was, 13,946,000, and still lost. Although, if you're wanting to see what the biggest rankings for biggest ever popular vote, so Major's at the top, but somebody comes in between Major and Attlee. Somebody we all love. We all love. I think you know who I'm talking about. Our favourite, Boris Johnson. So he got 13,966,000, which is, say, 20,000 more than Attlee.
That's amazing. Well, of course, that vote hadn't taken place when we did the podcast with Cole.
That's true.
So that came in after his question.
Hopefully, you'll have some sort of brain teaser. It could be something to do with your book. It can be easy. And, you know, set something for people to have a listen to and get in touch. And if they can't just Google it, that's good.
Mm.
Like it could be, if it was me, I'd be saying, you know, what's my favourite television programme? Easy answer, The Rockford Files.
Is it?
Come on, The Rockford Files.
I love The Rockford Files. Yeah. I didn't know it was your favourite.
There you go. That's been my favourite for a long time.
Who would know that?
Exactly.
Yeah. What colour trousers have I got on? I mean, reminds me of that. There's a famous story there when there was an Irish family who went on to Family Fortunes once, And every answer they gave was so bizarre. I remember watching Bob Monkhouse doing a talk about this, and he said, there was one book that said, name something pink. And he went to the mum in the family and went, my jumper. How would 100 people in the street that they interviewed have known what she was going to be wearing that night? Yeah.
That's right. Anyway, back to you. What would be a good question? Could be something to do with your book or some other book you've written.
Boy, you didn't give me any notice on this. What was the title of my first published book?
Oh, that's a good one.
And I'm presuming this isn't entirely straightforward.
It'd be quite easy to find out, I guess. Maybe I should make it slightly more difficult.
Well, the first book you wrote, was you were age 4 or 6 or something like that?
Yes, but that wasn't published, was it? Well, except by me many years later on YouTube.
Okay. So.
Well, that's quite a nice one to do.
So you wrote a book. Did it have a title, this book you
it
wrote?
It did, when yes.
Well, why don't we get people to see if they can work out what the title of your first ever book that you wrote was?
Okay, yes. What was the title?
Do you remember that?
I do, yes. Well, but it would be easy to track it down, actually, because it was only 6 pages long, and I made a little slideshow of those 6 pages put to some music. It only lasts about 30 seconds or something, because, I mean, there were about 6 words per page. I was only 4. It was a great big scrawling letters.
Okay, so you wrote, when you were about 4, you wrote a book about 6 pages long, maybe, and you remember the title?
I do remember the title.
So, can you work out or guess the name of Peter May's first book, the first book that he wrote, not the first book that he had published, the first book that he wrote?
So how will they tell us?
Oh yes, that's a good point. How will they tell us? The best way is to email us. We'd like a word at gmail.com. And that's, as we've said before, we're really sorry about this. There are no apostrophes allowed. So it's actually going to be wed like a word. Wed like a word at gmail.com. And we always like to hear from you other suggestions of books we should look at, people we should speak to, any comments. And you can, again, email us wed like a word at gmail.com or contact us over Twitter. Not with your competition answer, though. Contact us over Twitter at We'd like a word, strictly speaking, at We'd like a word.
Indeed. Now I've got one more area I want to ask Peter about before we let him go back to his life, and that is Second Life. Hi. I was quite fascinated that you wrote a standalone thriller called Virtually Dead.
Yes,
I think it was. And you spent a year living as an avatar in the online world of Second Life. But the thing that I found intriguing about this is that you opened a detective agency in Second Life, in this virtual universe, in this virtual world. You were called Flick Falls, I think, wasn't it? The Flick Falls, the detective?
Flick Falls Detective Agency.
And the thing that got me was when I read about this, it said, and I quote, he was hired by clients for cases ranging from protection from harassment by stalkers to surveillance and infidelity investigations. Yes. Now, are these virtual crimes, or is this someone getting hold of you through Second Life to look at real things?
No, it was all happening in the virtual world. It was my very first clients were a couple of giant geckos.
I'm glad you asked about this.
I know.
Yeah, and they were being harassed on their private jet by this, I can't remember his name, so this bad guy, you know. So I tracked him down and threatened him with expulsion from Second Life. But most of the cases were infidelity. The thing about Second Life is that people go in there and they create their avatars, and most of the avatars they create are beautiful, mm-hmm. You know. The guys are all handsome, the girls are all voluptuous.
The geckos are gorgeous.
Beautiful, yeah. And of course what happens is they have relationships.
Is that, yeah?
And just like in real life, they start cheating on one another. And so people would come to my agency and say, I'm having a relationship with, you know, blue-eyed Jack. And I think he's cheating on me. Could you look into it? And so I would. I would track down blue-eyed Jack and set up a tail and follow him. And if I was lucky, I would catch him in the act, so to speak. And of course, you can photograph within Second Life. So I could get photographic evidence, which was actually, it could be quite emotional and quite painful, because you're then confronting somebody who has an emotional relationship with this person. And you're saying, yes, they are cheating on you, and here is the evidence. And some people were really quite distraught by that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is about things like Second Life and those kind of... it's even worse with VR, because it's 3D and you're really in the room. But as you say, people actually get emotionally involved. There was a BBC documentary a few years ago all about virtual adultery, where someone had actually, in real life, had left their partner to go and meet the person who was behind the avatar that their avatar had fallen in love with. And, of course, it all fell apart. It didn't work. But this is happening, and I've got friends who work in cybercrime. And they said that the virtual world is leeching into the real world now. There's been a couple of test cases, not in the UK yet, but there's been a couple of test cases where they've started to talk about property being stolen that doesn't physically exist, where people have actually stolen like a sword that's worth 1,000 credits or something like that, and from someone else within a game, and that's now being held as theft. Because it is something that does have value, even though it doesn't exist. We've heard people who've sort of been selling Pokemon tokens and things to each other and things like this. It's a whole new world. Well, and
the thing that first attracted me to Second Life was a piece I saw, a news item, about crime that was taking place within Second Life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it has its own economy and its own currency, it was being used for money laundering quite extensively. Virtual property was changing hands for vast amounts of money, and it was a perfect way of laundering. And they were also talking about how terrorists used it as a meeting place, because nobody could be overheard. They would go in with their avatars. And
so what kind of avatars would they have? Kind of balaclavas or what?
No, the avatars are really very sophisticated these days.
Geckos. It's all geckos.
You can't blame everything on geckos.
Well, the geckos are there, but most people have human avatars. And some people have multiple avatars and change appearance at will. And some of them have pet dragons and goodness knows what else. But other than that, it's really quite like real life.
Well, I did hear a story a little while ago about, I don't know whether it was Second Life, but it was that kind of virtual environment which people were using to set up hits, to arrange to meet hitmen, basically. So because you've got two entirely anonymized avatars meeting, arranging all the details, then going their separate ways. With like, unless you're very clever, almost like no data trail about who was who.
Well, that's right. Yes, and that could work. And I know that these days the dark web is used fairly extensively for this kind of thing, and that Bitcoin is used as the currency. But you could easily do it in Second Life and use the Linden dollar.
Well, after scaring us virtually and on pages, Peter May, thank you very much indeed. You have been listening to We'd Like a Word. Thank you very much. I've been Paul Waters.
And I've been Stephen Colgan, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.